Nation, Kennedy attracted fantasies of America's lost innocence with his call for a renaissance of the pioneer spirit, a new frontier. Of all the character types, the mythic star is perhaps the most powerful of all. People are divided by all kinds of consciously recognized categories: race, gender, class, religion, politics. It is impossible, then, to gain power on a grand scale or to win an election by drawing on conscious awareness. An appeal to any one group will only alienate another. Unconsciously, however, there is much we share. All of us are mortal. All of us know fear. All of us have been stamped with the imprint of parent figures, and nothing conjures up this shared experience more than myth. The patterns of myth, born out of warring feelings of helplessness on the one hand and thirst for immortality on the other, are deeply engraved in us all. Mythic stars are figures of myth come to life. To appropriate their power, you must first study their physical presence, how they adopt a distinctive style, are cool, and visually arresting. Then you must assume the pose of a mythic figure. The rebel, the wise patriarch, the adventurer. The pose of a star who has struck one of these mythic poses might do the trick. Make these connections vague. They should never be obvious to the conscious mind. Your words and actions should invite interpretation beyond their surface appearance. You should seem to be dealing not with specific nitty-gritty issues and details, but with matters of life and death, love and hate, authority and chaos. Your opponent, similarly, should be framed not merely as an enemy for reasons of ideology or competition, but as a villain, a demon. People are hopelessly susceptible to myth, so make yourself the hero of a great drama. And keep your distance. Let people identify with you without being able to touch you. They can only watch and dream. A quote by Jacqueline Kennedy a week after John Kennedy's death. Jack's life had more to do with myth, magic, legend, saga, and story than with political theory or political science. Keys to the character. Seduction is a form of persuasion that seeks to bypass consciousness, stirring the unconscious mind instead. The reason for this is simple. We are so surrounded by stimuli that compete for our attention, bombarding us with obvious messages, and by people who are overtly political and manipulative, that we are rarely charmed or deceived by them. We have grown increasingly cynical. Try to persuade a person by appealing to their consciousness, by saying outright what you want, by showing all your cards, and what hope do you have? You are just one more irritation to be tuned out. To avoid this fate, you must learn the art of insinuation, of reaching the unconscious. The most eloquent expression of the unconscious is the dream, which is intricately connected to myth. Waking from a dream, we are often haunted by its images and ambiguous messages. Dreams obsess us because they mix the real and the unreal. They are filled with real characters and often deal with real situations. Yet they are delightfully irrational, pushing realities to the extremes of delirium. If everything in a dream were realistic, it would have no power over us. If everything were unreal, we would feel less involved in its pleasures and fears. Its fusion of the two is what makes it haunting. This is what Freud called the uncanny. Something that seems simultaneously strange and familiar. We sometimes experience the uncanny in waking life, in a déjà vu, a miraculous coincidence, a weird event that recalls a childhood experience. People can have a similar effect. The gestures, the words, the very being of men like Kennedy or Andy Warhol, for example, evoke both the real and the unreal. We may not imagine it, and how could we, really, but they are like dream figures to us. They have qualities that anchor them in reality, sincerity, playfulness, sensuality, but at the same time, their aloofness, their superiority, their almost surreal quality makes them seem like something out of a movie. These types have a haunting, obsessive effect on people. Whether in public or in private, they seduce us, making us want to possess them both physically and psychologically. But how can we possess a person from a dream, or a movie star, or a political star, or even one of those real-life fascinators like a Warhol, who may cross our path? Unable to have them, we become obsessed with them. They haunt our thoughts, our dreams, our fantasies. We imitate them unconsciously. The psychologist Sándor Ferenczi calls this introjection. Another person becomes part of our ego. We internalize their character. That is the insidious, seductive power of a star, a power you can appropriate by making yourself into a cipher, a mix of the real and the unreal. Most people are hopelessly banal. That is, far too real. What you need to do is etherealize yourself. Your words and actions seem to come from your unconscious, have a certain looseness to them. You hold yourself back, occasionally revealing a trait that makes people wonder whether they really know you. The star is a creation of modern cinema. That is no surprise. Film recreates the dream world. We watch a movie in the dark, in a semi-somnolent state. The images are real enough and to varying degrees depict realistic situations, but they are projections, flickering lights, images. We know they are not real. It's as if we were watching someone else's dream. It was the cinema, not the theater, that created the star. On a theater stage, actors are far away, lost in the crowd, too real in their bodily presence. What enabled film to manufacture the star was the close-up, which suddenly separates actors from their contexts, filling your mind with their image. The close-up seems to reveal something not so much about the character they are playing, but about themselves. We glimpse something of Greta Garbo herself when we look so closely into her face. Never forget this while fashioning yourself as a star. First, you must have such a large presence that you can fill your target's mind the way a close-up fills the screen. You must have a style or presence that makes you stand out from everyone else. Be vague and dreamlike, yet not distant or absent. You don't want people to be unable to focus on or remember you. They have to be seeing you in their minds when you are not there. Second, cultivate a blank, mysterious face, the center that radiates starness. This allows people to read into you whatever they want to, imagining they can see your character, even your soul. Instead of signaling moods and emotions, instead of emoting or over-emoting, the star draws in interpretations. That is the obsessive power in the face of Garbo or Dietrich, or even of Kennedy, who molded his expressions on James Dean's. A living thing is dynamic and changing, while an object or image is passive, but in its passivity, it stimulates our fantasies. A person can gain that power by becoming a kind of object. The great 18th century charlatan, Count Saint-Germain, was in many ways a precursor of the star. He would suddenly appear in town. No one knew from where. He spoke many languages, but his accent belonged to no single country. Nor was it clear how old he was. Not young, clearly, but his face had a healthy glow. The Count only went out at night. He always wore black, and also spectacular jewels. Arriving at the court of Louis XV, he was an instant sensation. He reeked wealth, but no one knew its source. He made the king and Madame de Pompadour believe he had fantastic powers, including even the ability to turn base matter into gold, the gift of the philosopher's stone. But he never made any great claims for himself. It was all insinuation. He never said yes or no, only perhaps. He would sit down for dinner, but was never seen eating. He once gave Madame de Pompadour a gift of candies in a box that changed color and aspect depending on how she held it. This entrancing object, she said, reminded her of the Count himself. Saint-Germain painted the strangest paintings anyone had ever seen. The colors were so vibrant that when he painted jewels, people thought they were real. Painters were desperate to know his secrets, but he never revealed them. He would leave town as he had entered, suddenly and quietly. His greatest admirer was Casanova, who met him and never forgot him. When he died, no one believed it. Years, decades, a century later, people were certain he was hiding somewhere. A person with powers like his never dies. The Count had all the star qualities. Everything about him was ambiguous and open to interpretation. Colorful and vibrant, he stood out from the crowd. People thought he was immortal, just as a star seems neither to age nor to disappear. His words were like his presence, fascinating, diverse, strange, their meaning unclear. Such is the power you can command by transforming yourself into a glittering object. Andy Warhol, too, obsessed everyone who knew him. He had a distinctive style, those silver wigs, and his face was blank and mysterious. People never knew what he was thinking. Like his paintings, he was pure surface. In the quality of their presence, Warhol and Saint-Germain recall the great trompe d'oeil paintings of the 17th century, or the prints of M.C. Escher. Fascinating mixtures of realism and impossibility, which make people wonder if they are real or imaginary. A star must stand out, and this may involve a certain dramatic flair of the kind that Dietrich revealed in her appearances at parties. Sometimes, though, a more haunting, dreamlike effect can be created by subtle touches. The way you smoke a cigarette, a vocal inflection, a way of walking. It's often the little things that get under people's skin and make them imitate you. The lock of hair over Veronica Lake's right eye, Cary Grant's voice, Kennedy's ironic smile. Although these nuances may barely register to the conscious mind, subliminally they can be as attractive as an object with a striking shape or odd color. Unconsciously, we are strangely drawn to things that have no meaning beyond their fascinating appearance. Stars make us want to know more about them. You must learn to stir people's curiosity by letting them glimpse something in your private life, something that seems to reveal an element of your personality. Let them fantasize and imagine. A trait that often triggers this reaction is a hint of spirituality, which can be devilishly seductive, like James Dean's interest in Eastern philosophy and the occult. Hints of goodness and big-heartedness can have a similar effect. Stars are like the gods on Mount Olympus, who live for love and play. The things you love, people, hobbies, animals, reveal the kind of moral beauty that people like to see in a star. Exploit this desire by showing people peaks of your private life, the causes you fight for, the person you are in love with for the moment. Another way stars seduce is by making us identify with them, giving us a vicarious thrill. This is what Kennedy did in his press conference about Truman. In positioning himself as a young man wronged by an older man, evoking an archetypal generational conflict, he made young people identify with him. The popularity in Hollywood movies of the figure of the disaffected, wronged adolescent helped him here. The key is to represent a type. As Jimmy Stewart represented the quintessential middle American, Cary Grant the smooth aristocrat. People of your type will gravitate to you, identify with you, share your joy or pain. The attraction must be unconscious, conveyed not in your words, but in your pose, your attitude. Now, more than ever, people are insecure and their identities are in flux. Help them fix on a role to play in life, and they will flock to identify with you. Simply make your type dramatic, noticeable, and easy to imitate. The power you have in influencing people's sense of self in this matter is insidious and profound. Remember, everyone is a public performer. People never know exactly what you think or feel. They judge you on your appearance. You are an actor, and the most effective actors have an inner distance. Like Dietrich, they can mold their physical presence as if they perceived it from the outside. This inner distance fascinates us. Stars are playful about themselves, always adjusting their image, adapting it to the times. Nothing is more laughable than an image that was fashionable 10 years ago, but isn't anymore. Stars must always renew their luster, or face the worst possible fate. Oblivion. Dangers. Stars create illusions that are pleasurable to see. The danger is that people tire of them, the illusion no longer fascinates, and turn to another star. Let this happen and you will find it very difficult to regain your place in the galaxy. You must keep all eyes on you at any cost. Do not worry about notoriety or about slurs on your image. We are remarkably forgiving of our stars. After the death of President Kennedy, all kinds of unpleasant truths came to light about him, the endless affairs, the addiction to risk and danger. None of this diminished his appeal, and in fact, the public still considers him one of America's greatest presidents. Errol Flynn faced many scandals, including a notorious rape case. They only enhanced his rakish image. Once people have recognized a star, any kind of publicity, even bad, simply feeds the obsession. Of course, you can go too far. People like a star to have a transcendent beauty, and too much human frailty will eventually disillusion them. But bad publicity is less of a danger than disappearing for too long or growing too distant. You cannot haunt people's dreams if they never see you. At the same time, you cannot let the public get too familiar with you or let your image become predictable. People will turn against you in an instant if you begin to bore them, for boredom is the ultimate social evil. Perhaps the greatest danger stars face is the endless attention they elicit. Obsessive attention can become disconcerting and worse. As any attractive woman can attest, it is tiring to be gazed at all the time, and the effect can be destructive, as is shown by the story of Marilyn Monroe. The solution is to develop the kind of distance from yourself that Dietrich had. Take the attention and idolatry with a grain of salt, and maintain a certain detachment from them. Approach your own image playfully. Most important, never become obsessed with the obsessive quality of people's interest in you. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the star. A quotation by Erich Maria Remarque on Marlene Dietrich. The cool, bright face which didn't ask for anything, which simply existed, waiting. It was an empty face, he thought, a face that could change with any wind of expression. One could dream into it anything. It was like a beautiful empty house waiting for carpets and pictures. It had all possibilities. It could become a palace or a brothel. It depended on the one who filled it. How limited, by comparison, was all that was already completed and labeled. A quote by André Malraux. Marlene Dietrich is not an actress like Sarah Bernhardt. She is a myth like Phryne. From Ovid's Metamorphoses. When Pygmalion saw these women living such wicked lives, he was revolted by the many faults which nature has implanted in the female sex, and long lived a bachelor existence without any wife to share his home. But meanwhile, with marvelous artistry, he skillfully carved a snowy ivory statue. He made it lovelier than any woman born, and fell in love with his own creation. The statue had all the appearance of a real girl, so that it seemed to be alive, to want to move, did not modesty forbid. So cleverly did his art conceal its art. Pygmalion gazed in wonder, and in his heart there rose a passionate love for this image of a human form. Often he ran his hands over the work, feeling it to see whether it was flesh or ivory, and would not yet admit that ivory was all it was. He kissed the statue, and imagined that it kissed him back, spoke to it, and embraced it, and thought he felt his fingers sink into the limbs he touched, so that he was afraid lest a bruise appear where he had pressed the flesh. Sometimes he addressed it in flattering speeches, sometimes brought the kind of presents that girls enjoy. He dressed the limbs of his statue in woman's robes, and put rings on its fingers, long necklaces round its neck. All this finery became the image well, but it was no less lovely unadorned. Pygmalion then placed the statue on a couch that was covered with cloths of Tyrian purple, laid its head to rest on soft down pillows as if it could appreciate them, and called it his bedfellow. The festival of Venus, which is celebrated with the greatest pomp all through Cyprus, was now in progress, and heifers, their crooked horns gilded for the occasion, had fallen at the altar as the axe struck their snowy necks. Smoke was rising from the incense when Pygmalion, having made his offering, stood by the altar and timidly prayed, saying, "If you gods can give all things, may I have, as my wife, I pray." He did not dare to say, "the ivory maiden," but finished, "one like the ivory maid." However, golden Venus, present at her festival in person, understood what his prayers meant. And as a sign that the gods were kindly disposed, the flames burned up three times, shooting a tongue of fire into the air. When Pygmalion returned home, he made straight for the statue of the girl he loved, leaned over the couch, and kissed her. She seemed warm. He laid his lips on hers again and touched her breast with his hands. At his touch, the ivory lost its hardness and grew soft. A quote by John Hellman from The Kennedy Obsession, The American Myth of JFK. John F. Kennedy brought to television news and photojournalism the components most prevalent in the world of film, star quality and mythic story. With his telegenic looks, skills at self-presentation, heroic fantasies, and creative intelligence, Kennedy was brilliantly prepared to project a major screen persona. He appropriated the discourses of mass culture, especially of Hollywood, and transferred them to the news. By this strategy, he made the news like dreams and like the movies, a realm in which images played out scenarios that accorded with the viewer's deepest yearnings, never appearing in an actual film, but rather turning the television apparatus into his screen. He became the greatest movie star of the 20th century. A quote from Edgar Morin's The Stars. But we have seen that, considered as a total phenomenon, the history of the stars repeats, in its own proportions, the history of the gods. Before the gods, before the stars, the mythical universe, the screen, was peopled with specters or phantoms, endowed with the glamour and magic of the double. Several of these presences have progressively assumed body and substance, have taken form, amplified, and flowered into gods and goddesses. And even as certain major gods of the ancient pantheons metamorphosed themselves into hero gods of salvation, the star goddesses humanize themselves and become new mediators between the fantastic world of dreams and man's daily life on Earth. The heroes of the movies are, in an obviously attenuated way, mythological heroes in this sense of becoming divine. The star is the actor or actress who absorbs some of the heroic, i.e. divinized and mythic, substance of the hero or heroine of the movies, and who, in turn, enriches this substance by his or her own contribution. When we speak of the myth of the star, we mean, first of all, the process of divinization, which the movie actor undergoes, a process that makes him the idol of crowds. A quote from J.P. Mayer's British Cinemas and Their Audiences. Age, 22. Sex, female. Nationality, British. Profession, medical student. Quote, Deanna Durbin became my first and only screen idol. I wanted to be as much like her as possible, both in my manners and clothes. Whenever I was to get a new dress, I would find from my collection a particularly nice picture of Deanna and ask for a dress like she was wearing. I did my hair as much like hers as I could manage. If I found myself in any annoying or aggravating situation, I found myself wondering what Deanna would do, and modified my own reactions accordingly. Age, 26, sex, female, nationality, British. I only fell in love once with a movie actor. It was Conrad Veidt. His magnetism and his personality got me. His voice and gestures fascinated me. I hated him, feared him, loved him. When he died, it seemed to me that a vital part of my imagination died too, and my world of dreams was bare. A quote by George Bernard Shaw. The savage worships idols of wood and stone. The civilized man, idols of flesh and blood. A quote by Ibn Hazm from The Ring of the Dove, a treatise on the art and practice of Arab love. When the eye's rays encounter some clear, well-polished object, be it burnished steel or glass or water, a brilliant stone or any other polished and gleaming substance having luster, glitter, and sparkle, those rays of the eye are reflected back, and the observer then beholds himself and obtains an ocular vision of his own person. This is what you see when you look into a mirror. In that situation, you are, as it were, looking at yourself through the eyes of another. A quote from Jean Baudrillard's Seduction. The only important constellation of collective seduction produced by modern times is that of film stars or cinema idols. They were our only myth in an age incapable of generating great myths or figures of seduction comparable to those of mythology or art. The cinema's power lives in its myth. Its stories, its psychological portraits, its imagination or realism, the meaningful impressions it leaves, these are all secondary. Only the myth is powerful. And at the heart of the cinematographic myth lies seduction, that of the renowned seductive figure, a man or woman, but above all a woman, linked to the ravishing but specious power of the cinematographic image itself. The star is by no means an ideal or sublime being. She is artificial. Her presence serves to submerge all sensibility and expression beneath a ritual fascination with the void, beneath ecstasy of her gaze and the nullity of her smile. This is how she achieves mythical status and becomes subject to collective rites of sacrificial adulation. The ascension of the cinema idols, the masses' divinities, was and remains a central story of modern times. There is no point in dismissing it as merely the dreams of mystified masses. It is a seductive occurrence. To be sure, seduction in the age of the masses is no longer like that of Les Liaisons Dangereuses or The Seducer's Diary, nor, for that matter, like that found in ancient mythology, which undoubtedly contains the story's richest in seduction. In these, seduction is hot, while that of our modern idols is cold, being at the intersection of two cold mediums, that of the image and that of the masses. The great stars or seductresses never dazzle because of their talent or intelligence, but because of their absence. They are dazzling in their nullity, and in their coldness, the coldness of makeup and ritual hieraticism. These great seductive effigies are our masks, our Eastern Island statues. A quote from Andy Warhol. If you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings and films and me. And there I am. There's nothing behind it. The Anti-Seducer. Seducers draw you in by the focused, individualized attention they pay to you. Anti-seducers are the opposite. Insecure, self-absorbed, and unable to grasp the psychology of another person, they literally repel. Anti-seducers have no self-awareness and never realize when they are pestering, imposing, talking too much. They lack the subtlety to create the promise of pleasure that seduction requires. Root out anti-seductive qualities in yourself and recognize them in others. There is no pleasure or profit in dealing with the anti-seducer. Typology of the anti-seducers. Anti-seducers come in many shapes and kinds, but almost all of them share a single attribute, the source of their repellence, insecurity. We are all insecure, and we suffer for it. Yet we are able to surmount these feelings at times. A seductive engagement can bring us out of our usual self-absorption, and to the degree that we seduce or are seduced, we feel charged and confident. Anti-seducers, however, are insecure to such a degree that they cannot be drawn into the seductive process. Their needs, their anxieties, their self-consciousness close them off. They interpret the slightest ambiguity on your part as a slight to their ego. They see the merest hint of withdrawal as a betrayal and are likely to complain bitterly about it. It seems easy. Anti-seducers repel, so be repelled. Avoid them. Unfortunately, however, many anti-seducers cannot be detected as such at first glance. They are more subtle, and unless you're careful, they will ensnare you in a most unsatisfying relationship. You must look for clues to their self-involvement and insecurity. Perhaps they are ungenerous, or they argue with unusual tenacity, or are excessively judgmental. Perhaps they lavish you with undeserved praise, declaring their love before knowing anything about you. Or more important, they pay no attention to details. Since they cannot see what makes you different, they cannot surprise you with nuanced attention. It is critical to recognize anti-seductive qualities, not only in others, but also in ourselves. Almost all of us have one or two of the anti-seducer's qualities latent in our character, and to the extent that we can consciously root them out, we become more seductive. A lack of generosity, for instance, need not signal an anti-seducer if it is a person's only fault. But an ungenerous person is seldom truly attractive. Seduction implies opening yourself up, even if only for the purposes of deception. Being unable to give by spending money usually means being unable to give in general. Stamp ungenerosity out. It is an impediment to power and a gross sin in seduction. It is best to disengage from anti-seducers early on, before they sink their needy tentacles into you. So learn to read the signs. These are the main types. The Brute. If seduction is a kind of ceremony or ritual, part of the pleasure is its duration, the time it takes, the waiting that increases anticipation. Brutes have no patience for such things. They are concerned only with their own pleasure, never with yours. To be patient is to show that you are thinking of the other person, which never fails to impress. Impatience has the opposite effect. Assuming you are so interested in them, you have no reason to wait. Brutes offend you with their egotism. Underneath that egotism, too, there is often a gnawing sense of inferiority. And if you spurn them or make them wait, they overreact. If you suspect you're dealing with a brute, do a test. Make that person wait. His or her response will tell you everything you need to know. The Suffocator. Suffocators fall in love with you before you're even half aware of their existence. The trait is deceptive. You might think they have found you overwhelming, but the fact is they suffer from an inner void, a deep well of need that cannot be filled. Never get involved with suffocators. They are almost impossible to free yourself from without trauma. They cling to you until you are forced to pull back, whereupon they smother you with guilt. We tend to idealize a loved one, but love takes time to develop. Recognize suffocators by how quickly they adore you. To be so admired may give a momentary boost to your ego, but deep inside, you sense that their intense emotions are not related to anything you have done. Trust these instincts. A subvariant of the suffocator is the doormat, a person who slavishly imitates you. Spot these types early on by seeing whether they are capable of having an idea of their own. An inability to disagree with you is a bad sign. The moralizer. Seduction is a game and should be undertaken with a light heart. All is fair in love and seduction. Morality never enters the picture. The character of the moralizer, however, is rigid. These are people who follow fixed ideas and try to make you bend to their standards. They want to change you, to make you a better person, so they endlessly criticize and judge. That is their pleasure in life. In truth, their moral ideas stem from their own unhappiness and mask their desire to dominate those around them. Their inability to adapt and to enjoy makes them easy to recognize. Their mental rigidity may also be accompanied by a physical stiffness. It's hard not to take their criticisms personally, so it is better to avoid their presence and their poisoned comments. The tightwad. Cheapness signals more than a problem with money. It is a sign of something constricted in a person's character, something that keeps them from letting go or taking a risk. It is the most anti-seductive trait of all, and you cannot allow yourself to give in to it. Most tightwads don't realize they have a problem. They actually imagine that when they give someone some paltry crumb, they are being generous. Take a hard look at yourself. You are probably cheaper than you think. Try giving more freely of both your money and yourself, and you will see the seductive potential in selective generosity. Of course, you must keep your generosity under control. Giving too much can be a sign of desperation, as if you were trying to buy someone. The bumbler. Bumblers are self-conscious, and their self-consciousness heightens your own. At first, you may think they're thinking about you, and so much so that it makes them awkward. In fact, they are only thinking of themselves, worrying about how they look, or about the consequences for them of their attempt to seduce you. Their worry is usually contagious. Soon, you are worrying too, about yourself. Bumblers rarely reach the final stages of a seduction, but if they get that far, they bungle that too. In seduction, the key weapon is boldness, refusing the target the time to stop and think. Bumblers have no sense of timing. You might find it amusing to try to train or educate them, but if they're still bumblers past a certain age, the case is probably hopeless. They are incapable of getting outside themselves. The windbag. The most effective seductions are driven by looks, indirect actions, physical lures. Words have a place. But too much talk will generally break the spell, heightening surface differences and weighing things down. People who talk a lot most often talk about themselves. They have never acquired that inner voice that wonders, "Am I boring you?" To be a windbag is to have a deep-rooted selfishness. Never interrupt or argue with these types. That only fuels their windbaggery. At all costs, learn to control your own tongue. The reactor. Reactors are far too sensitive, not to you, but to their own egos. They comb your every word and action for signs of a slight to their vanity. If you strategically back off, as you sometimes must in seduction, they will brood and lash out at you. They are prone to whining and complaining, two very anti-seductive traits. Test them by telling a gentle joke or story at their expense. We should all be able to laugh at ourselves a little, but the reactor cannot. You can read the resentment in their eyes. Erase any reactive qualities in your own character. They unconsciously repel people. The Vulgarian. Vulgarians are inattentive to the details that are so important in seduction. You can see this in their personal appearance. Their clothes are tasteless by any standard, and in their actions, they do not know that it's sometimes better to control oneself and refuse to give in to one's impulses. Vulgarians will blab, saying anything in public. They have no sense of timing and are rarely in harmony with your tastes. Indiscretion is a sure sign of the vulgarian talking to others of your affair, for example. It may seem impulsive, but its real source is their radical selfishness, their inability to see themselves as others see them. More than just avoiding vulgarians, you must make yourself their opposite. Tact, style, and attention to detail are all basic requirements of a seducer. Examples of the anti-seducer. 1. Claudius, the step-grandson of the great Roman Emperor Augustus, was considered something of an imbecile as a young man, and was treated badly by almost everyone in his family. His nephew, Caligula, who became emperor in 37 AD, made it a sport to torture him, making him run around the palace at top speed as penance for his stupidity, having soiled sandals tied to his hands at supper, and so on. As Claudius grew older, he seemed to become even more slow-witted, and while all of his relatives lived under the constant threat of assassination, he was left alone. So it came as a great surprise to everyone, including Claudius himself, that when in 41 AD a cabal of soldiers assassinated Caligula, they also proclaimed Claudius emperor. Having no desire to rule, he delegated most of the governing to confidants, a group of freed slaves, and spent his time doing what he loved best, eating, drinking, gambling, and whoring. Claudius's wife, Valeria Messalina, was one of the most beautiful women in Rome. Although he seemed fond of her, Claudius paid her no attention, and she started to have affairs. At first she was discreet, but over the years, provoked by her husband's neglect, she became more and more debauched. She had a room built for her in the palace, where she entertained scores of men, doing her best to imitate the most notorious prostitute in Rome, whose name was written on the door. Any man who refused her advances was put to death. Almost everyone in Rome knew about these frolics, but Claudius said nothing. He seemed oblivious. So great was Messalina's passion for her favorite lover, Gaius Silius, that she decided to marry him, although both of them were married already. While Claudius was away, they held a wedding ceremony, authorized by a marriage contract that Claudius himself had been tricked into signing. After the ceremony, Gaius moved into the palace. Now the shock and disgust of the whole city finally forced Claudius into action, and he ordered the execution of Gaius and of Messalina's other lovers, but not of Messalina herself. Nevertheless, a gang of soldiers, inflamed by the scandal, hunted her down and stabbed her to death. When this was reported to the emperor, he merely ordered more wine and continued his meal. Several nights later, to the amazement of his slaves, he asked why the empress wasn't joining him for dinner. Nothing is more infuriating than being paid no attention. In the process of seduction, you may have to pull back at times, subjecting your target to moments of doubt. But prolonged inattention will not only break the seductive spell, it can create hatred. Claudius was an extreme of this behavior. His insensitivity was created by necessity. In acting like an imbecile, he hid his ambition and protected himself among dangerous competitors. But the insensitivity became second nature. Claudius grew slovenly, and no longer noticed what was going on around him. His inattentiveness had a profound effect on his wife. How, she wondered, can a man, especially a physically unappealing man like Claudius, not notice me or care about my affairs with other men? But nothing she did seemed to matter to him. Claudius marks the extreme, but the spectrum of inattention is wide. A lot of people pay too little attention to the details, the signals another person gives. Their senses are dulled by work, by hardship, by self-absorption. We often see this turning off the seductive charge between two people, notably between couples who have been together for years. Carried further, it will stir angry, bitter feelings. Often the one who has been cheated on by a partner started the dynamic by patterns of inattention. 2. In 1639, a French army besieged and took possession of the Italian city of Turin. Two French officers, the Chevalier, later Count de Gramont, and his friend, Mata, decided to turn their attention to the city's beautiful women. The wives of some of Turin's most illustrious men were more than susceptible. Their husbands were busy and kept mistresses of their own. The wives' only requirement was that the suitor play by the rules of gallantry. The Chevalier and Mata were quick to find partners, the Chevalier choosing the beautiful Mademoiselle de Saint-Germain, who was soon to be betrothed, and Mata offering his services to an older and more experienced woman, Madame de Senant. The Chevalier took to wearing green, Mata blue, these being their ladies' favorite colors. On the second day of their courtships, the couples visited a palace outside the city. The Chevalier was all charm, making Mademoiselle de Saint-Germain laugh uproariously at his witticisms. But Mata didn't fare so well. He had no patience for this gallantry business, and when he and Madame de Senant took a stroll, he squeezed her hand and boldly declared his affections. The lady, of course, was aghast. And when they got back to Turin, she left without looking at him. Unaware that he had offended her, Mata imagined that she was overcome with emotion and felt rather pleased with himself. But the Chevalier de Gramont, wondering why the pair had parted, visited Madame de Senant and asked her how it went. She told him the truth. Mata had dispensed with the formalities and was ready to bed her. The Chevalier laughed and thought to himself how differently he would manage affairs if he were the one wooing the lovely madame. Over the next few days, Mata continued to misread the signs. He did not pay a visit to Madame de Senant's husband, as custom required. He didn't wear her colors. When the two went riding together, he went chasing after hares, as if they were the more interesting prey, and when he took snuff, he failed to offer her some. Meanwhile, he continued to make his over-forward advances. Finally, Madame had had enough and complained to him directly. Mata apologized. He had not realized his errors. Moved by his apology, the lady was more than ready to resume the courtship, but a few days later, after a few trifling stabs at wooing, Mata once again assumed that she was ready for bed. To his dismay, she refused him as before. "I do not think that women can be mightily offended," Mata told the Chevalier, "if one sometimes leaves off trifling to come to the point." But Madame de Senant would have nothing more to do with him, and the Chevalier de Gramont, seeing an opportunity he could not pass by, took advantage of her displeasure by secretly courting her properly, and eventually winning the favors that Mata had tried to force. There is nothing more anti-seductive than feeling that someone has assumed that you are theirs, that you cannot possibly resist them. The slightest appearance of this kind of conceit is deadly to seduction. You must prove yourself, take your time, win your target's heart. Perhaps you fear that he or she will be offended by a slower pace or will lose interest. It is more likely, however, that your fear reflects your own insecurity. And insecurity is always anti-seductive. In truth, the longer you take, the more you show the depth of your interest, and the deeper the spell you create. In a world of few formalities and ceremony, seduction is one of the few remnants from the past that retains the ancient patterns. It is a ritual, and its rites must be observed. Haste reveals not the depth of your feelings, but the degree of your self-absorption. It may be possible sometimes to hurry someone into love, but you will only be repaid by the lack of pleasure this kind of love affords. If you're naturally impetuous, do what you can to disguise it. Strangely enough, the effort you spend on holding yourself back may be read by your target as deeply seductive. 3. In Paris in the 1730s lived a young man named Mécour, who was just of an age to have his first affair. His mother's friend, Madame de Lourcey, a widow of around 40, was beautiful and charming, but had a reputation for being untouchable. As a boy, Mécour had been infatuated with her, but never expected his love would be returned. So it was with great surprise and excitement that he realized that now that he was old enough, Madame de Lourcey's tender looks seemed to indicate a more than motherly interest in him. For 2 months, Mécour trembled in de Lourcey's presence. He was afraid of her and didn't know what to do. One evening, they were discussing a recent play, how well one character had declared his love to a woman, Madame remarked. Noting Mécour's obvious discomfort, she went on, "If I am not mistaken, a declaration can only seem such an embarrassing matter because you yourself have one to make." Madame de Lourcey knew full well that she was the source of the young man's awkwardness, but she was a tease. "You must tell me," she said, "with whom you are in love." Finally, Mécour confessed it was indeed Madame whom he desired. His mother's friend advised him to not think of her that way, but she also sighed and gave him a long and languid look. Her words said one thing, her eyes another. Perhaps she was not as untouchable as he had thought. As the evening ended, though, Madame de Lourcey said she doubted his feelings would last, and she left young Mécour troubled that she had said nothing about reciprocating his love. Over the next few days, Mécour repeatedly asked de Lourcey to declare her love for him, and she repeatedly refused. Eventually, the young man decided his cause was hopeless and gave up. But a few nights later, at a soiree at her house, her dress seemed more enticing than usual, and her looks at him stirred his blood. He returned them and followed her around while she took care to keep a bit of distance lest others sense what was happening. Yet she also managed to arrange that he could stay without arousing suspicion when the other visitors left. When they were finally alone, she made him sit beside her on the sofa. He could barely speak. The silence was uncomfortable. To get him talking, she raised the same old subject. His youth would make his love for her a passing fancy. Instead of denying it, he looked dejected and continued to keep a polite distance, so that she finally exclaimed with obvious irony, "If it were known that you were here with my consent, that I had voluntarily arranged it with you, what might not people say? And yet how wrong they would be, for no one could be more respectful than you are." Goaded into action, Mécour grabbed her hand and looked her in the eye. She blushed and told him he should go, but the way she arranged herself on the sofa and looked back at him suggested he should do the opposite. Yet Mécour still hesitated. She had told him to go, and if he disobeyed, she might cause a scene and might never forgive him. He would have made a fool of himself, and everyone, including his mother, would hear of it. He soon got up, apologizing for his momentary boldness. Her astonished and somewhat cold look meant he had indeed gone too far, he imagined, and he said goodbye and left. Mécour and Madame de Lourcey appear in the novel The Wayward Head and Heart, written in 1738 by Crébillon Fils, who based his characters on libertines he knew in the France of the time. For Crébillon Fils, seduction is all about signs, about being able to send them and read them. This is not because sexuality is repressed and requires speaking in code. It is rather because wordless communication through clothes, gestures, and actions is the most pleasurable, exciting, and seductive form of language. In Crébillon-Fils's novel, Madame de Lourcey is an ingenious seductress who finds it exciting to initiate young men. But even she cannot overcome the youthful stupidity of Mécour, who is incapable of reading her signs because he is absorbed in his own thoughts. Later in the story, she does manage to educate him. But in real life, there are many who cannot be educated. They're too literal and insensitive to the details that contain seductive power. They do not so much repel as irritate and infuriate you by their constant misinterpretations, always viewing life from behind the screen of their ego and unable to see things as they really are. Mécour is so caught up in himself he cannot see that Madame is expecting him to make the bold move to which she will have to succumb. His hesitation shows that he's thinking of himself, not of her, that he is worrying about how he will look, not feeling overwhelmed by her charms. Nothing could be more anti-seductive. Recognize such types, and if they're past the young age that would give them an excuse, do not entangle yourself in their awkwardness. They will infect you with doubt. 4. In the Heian court of late 10th century Japan, the young nobleman Kaoru, purported son of the great seducer Genji himself, had had nothing but misfortune in love. He had become infatuated with a young princess, Oigimi, who lived in a dilapidated home in the countryside, her father having fallen on hard times. Then one day, he had an encounter with Oigimi's sister, Nakanokimi, that convinced him she was the one he actually loved. Confused, he returned to court and didn't visit the sisters for some time. Then their father died, followed shortly thereafter by Oigimi herself. Now, Kaoru realized his mistake. He had loved Oigimi all along, and she had died out of despair that he did not care for her. He would never meet her like again. She was all he could think about. When Nakanokimi, her father and sister dead, came to live at court, Kaoru had the house where Oigimi and her family had lived turned into a shrine. One day, Nakanokimi, seeing the melancholy into which Kaoru had fallen, told him that there was a third sister, Ukifune, who resembled his beloved Oigimi and lived hidden away in the countryside. Kaoru came to life. Perhaps he had a chance to redeem himself, to change the past. But how could he meet this woman? There came a time when he visited the shrine to pay his respects to the departed Oigimi, and heard that the mysterious Ukifune was there as well. Agitated and excited, he managed to catch a glimpse of her through the crack in a door. The sight of her took his breath away. Although she was a plain-looking country girl, in Kaoru's eyes, she was the living incarnation of Oigimi. Her voice, meanwhile, was like the voice of Nakanokimi, whom he had loved as well. Tears welled up in his eyes. A few months later, Kaoru managed to find a house in the mountains where Ukifune lived. He visited her there, and she did not disappoint. "I once had a glimpse of you through a crack in a door," he told her, "and you have been very much on my mind ever since." Then he picked her up in his arms and carried her to a waiting carriage. He was taking her back to the shrine, and the journey there brought back to him the image of Oigimi. Again, his eyes clouded with tears. Looking at Ukifune, he silently compared her to Oigimi. Her clothes were less nice, but she had beautiful hair. When Oigimi was alive, she and Kaoru had played the koto together. So, once at the shrine, he had kotos brought out. Ukifune did not play as well as Oigimi had, and her manners were less refined. Not to worry, he would give her lessons, change her into a lady. But then, as he had done with Oigimi, Kaoru returned to court, leaving Ukifune languishing at the shrine. Some time passed before he visited her again. She had improved, was more beautiful than before, but he couldn't stop thinking of Oigimi. Once again, he left her, promising to bring her to court, but more weeks passed and finally he received the news